Hello, folks. Welcome to First Thursday. This is Labor Relations Information Systems monthly podcast on recent developments in the public safety labor workplace. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host for the next 45 minutes or so. I've got some really interesting cases to talk to you about today, including a major firefighter staffing case out of Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission. I've also got a First Amendment case I want to discuss, how the First Amendment applies to safety complaints. But first, I want to talk some numbers, numbers and initials to be more specific. I want to talk about the American Health Care Act, the AHCA. This is the bill that passed the House of Representatives that would fundamentally alter the way health care is delivered in this country. Why am I talking about this in the context of a podcast about public safety labor relations? For two main reasons, other than just generally talking about healthcare. The first is it's predicted that the AHCA is going to have a very significant immediate effect on healthcare premiums, an immediate effect and then a contrary long-term effect. And I'll talk about how that can possibly be. And the second reason is the AHCA tinkers with the what's known as the Cadillac tax on health insurance. And I'll talk to you about how that will work as well. So, what is the AHCA? First of all, we should all get it out of our heads that the AHCA, some people call it Trump Care, some people call it Ryan Care, should get it out of our heads that the AHCA repeals the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. It doesn't. What it does is to graft a number of new provisions onto the Affordable Care Act. It adds several tax elements. Some people have rather cynically observed that the AHCA is really nothing more than a tax relief bill in the form of a medical insurance statute. But it leaves the guts of the Affordable Care Act in place. So when we think about the notion that there's been this public discussion of replacing Obamacare, that's not what this bill does. It's a very, very complicated bill. It actually wasn't given to the House of Representatives until about 24 hours before they voted on it. The House of Representatives held no hearings. The House did not submit the bill to the Congressional Budget Office to be scored. The word is scored. What the Congressional Budget Office does, CBO as it's known, I told you we're going to be into initials here and numbers. What the CBO does whenever any piece of legislation is being considered is it attaches a score to that bill. How much is it going to cost? What's the impact going to be on the federal deficit? What's the impact going to be on the budget? Very notably, the AHCA was not scored. There just simply wasn't time to score it. I don't think, bluntly, there was much desire of the proponents of it to score it before there was a vote. This thing went through in lightning speed, 24 hours, no hearings, no CBO score. Well, now we do have a CBO score on the bill. This happened last week, about this time last week. And the CBO has given us numbers that tell us not only what the impact on the federal budget and the federal deficit should be, I'm not going to talk about that at all, but has given us numbers as to what the likely impact on health care premiums will be. The health care premiums that all of us either pay or our employers pay, or the premiums are split between us. So let's start with the short-term impact of the AHCA on health care premiums. Before I get into those numbers, this all presumes that the Senate will approve the AHCA. As I'm recording that seems a little bit less likely than life being discovered on Mars, but you never know. Senator Mitch McConnell, who's the Senate Majority Leader, has convened a rump group of Republican senators who are working on the AHCA as we speak. We never know what's going to come out. We just know that this has been passed by the House of Representatives and very strongly endorsed by President Trump. So what's the immediate impact on premiums? The CBO estimates that the AHCA will cause a 20% premium increase in 2018. That 20% premium increase doesn't take into account medical inflation. And medical inflation costs over the last few years have been running at about the 8-9% range. A lot of large actuarial firms have projected that in 2017, the number will be right in between, that healthcare rates will increase by 8.5%. So if you add the 8.5% medical inflation rate to the 20% premium increase caused by the AHCA, we're looking at a whopper of a bill in 2018. A bill as in something we all have to pay in the context of collective bargaining negotiations as part of the total compensation package. We are looking at an increase in healthcare costs that may run as high as 30%. We haven't ever seen those numbers. So why the immediate increase in premiums? Well, there's essentially two reasons. First of all, the AHCA would remove some federal subsidies that have existed since Obamacare was passed, and those subsidies helped keep premiums down. Secondly, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that there will be people who will lose their health insurance as a result of the AHCA. How many of them? 23 million of them. Who will they be? Primarily, the CBO estimates, the poor and the elderly. Well, I am recording this for a bunch of public safety employees who listen to it, and you know firsthand, perhaps better than just about anyone else, are people who lose their health care insurance, are they going to go entirely without health care, or where are they going to get their health care? They're going to get it the way they got it years ago, right? They're going to present themselves in the emergency room of hospitals. They may not know the name of the Hill-Burton Act, but they will know that hospitals are under a federal obligation to treat them, and that's where they'll get their health care. And that is, of course, just about precisely the most expensive place any of us can get any health care. So hospitals will be treating an increased number of uninsured individuals. Will hospitals simply absorb those additional costs? Probably not. I think that's a pretty safe guess. They will pass it on in the form of increased costs to the rest of us, costs that will be paid by healthcare insurance. And that's why, that's the second of the two reasons, why healthcare rates will rise as a result of the AHCA. Now, the situation with premiums is predicted by the CBO to change over time. That 20% increase, that one-year increase from 2017 to 2018, that gets better in 2018 to 2019. Goes down from 20% to 5%. And that 5%, by the way, is also in addition to medical inflation. So we still have a tough year, one of the record years ever in 2019, looking ahead at that. But at least it won't be the huge, huge cost increase we see from this year to next. And over time, the premiums will relatively decline, to the point where the CBO is projecting that by 2026, healthcare premiums will be 10% lower than they are today. Once again, not taking into account medical inflation. So why? What's going on? We know why the increase in premiums immediately, why the eventual decrease in premiums over time? And this is where it gets a little bit more complicated. If it's not complicated enough already, this is where it gets more complicated. Not everyone's premiums are predicted to decline in the long term. The AHCA will allow states to opt out of Obamacare's mandate that all individuals be charged the same premium. And that means, depending upon your state, if you're in an opt-out state, it may be that insurance companies will charge individuals differently depending upon how likely they are to need medical care. The CBO is projecting, and it's fairly common sense projection, that in states that opt out, the elderly, those with chronic illnesses and the like, will pay higher premiums than those who are less likely to need medical care, the young. And the CBO goes through a very involved formula. It divides states into three groups. Do you opt out completely? Do you opt out partially? Do you not opt out at all? And the impact on premiums, of course, differs depending upon where you are. But eventually, the overall rate of medical insurance increases will drop. And it will drop, as I mentioned earlier, by 10% over today's numbers, not adjusted for inflation. So what's going on? Why is that all happening? The reason that medical insurance rates will drop is because of the effect of people losing insurance. It's by and large going to be people who are sicker, who will not be able to afford health insurance. And it's also those people, because of the opt-out features, and I'm not going to even get into what the AHCA does on Medicare, it's also going to be those people who are going to be charged the highest rate increases. The CBO estimates the premiums, non-Medicare premiums, so premiums for people who are older, people in their 50s and 60s, may rise by as much as, get ready, hold on to your hat, 800% because of the AHCA. The CBO goes through a huge breakdown as well as to the impact of premiums by income. And the CBO, of course, projects that lower income people would pay much larger premiums than younger, higher income people. So where does that all leave us with premiums? Well, the news immediately is terrible news, right? A 20% increase in premiums driven just by this bill, another 5% in the next year. That's pretty dreadful. But by 2026, you have to think about that. I'm being as venal as I can possibly be here. Public safety bargaining units tend to be younger and healthier. And the AHCA will make those premiums much more affordable by 2026. Of course, if you're in your 40s now and you're planning to retire, and you'll be retired by 2026, that may not be the good news for you. But maybe you can take some solace in the fact that who's ever replacing you in that bargaining unit will have much lower health care premiums. Now, the other salient feature of the AHCA that I want to talk about is what it does to the Cadillac tax. Remember the Cadillac tax, that feature of the Affordable Care Act that amounts to a 40% excise tax on high-benefit health care plans? And the amount of premium that the excise tax applies to is for full family coverage, anything more than $27,500 per year. That Cadillac tax was initially supposed to go into place in 2018. Thanks to a budget reconciliation bill in the last year of President Obama's tenure, that got delayed to 2020. The AHCA delays it to 2026. Although there's signals from the House of Representatives the representatives who supported the AHCA. There are signals that they put that provision in just as a placeholder, and they intend to consider legislation to move to an earlier implementation of the tax. We don't know one way or the other on that. So that's the AHCA. That's sort of the blockbuster in our total compensation structure when we're bargaining for next year. But we all need to take a deep breath on this, right? There's a lot of stuff in the AHCA that is a very difficult political proposition for the Senate. As Robert Frost once wrote at the end of a poem, and I'm going to mangle this because I'm not looking at it, we have miles to go before we sleep on this whole thing. The Senate's reception, particularly the reception of moderate Republican senators, has been less than enthusiastic. And many are predicting right now that if anything of the AHCA survives the Senate, it'll be substantially changed. Others are predicting that the Senate's simply not going to take the issue up. It just simply doesn't have the votes to do anything. And I haven't run into anybody online, that is, who actually seriously thinks that the Senate is going to pass the AHCA as written. So stay tuned. We'll be back on this issue. There's no question but that healthcare is going to be revisited and revisited and revisited over the course of the next 4 years. All right, let's talk firefighter safety and staffing and bargaining. Now, normally, wherever there's collective bargaining around the country for public safety employees, workplace safety is a mandatory subject of collective bargaining. And labor boards don't have a problem with that general proposition. They tend not to have a problem as to whether or not the safety of equipment or even whether or not certain equipment should be provided is a mandatory subject for collective bargaining. They think those are easy cases. There's plenty of cases, for example, for law enforcement officers dealing with whether officers have to buy their own weapons or buy their own ballistic vests or the replacement schedule for ballistic vests. So there's even a case out of New Jersey that says that the color of a light bar on a police car is a mandatory subject for bargaining because of the safety implications. Labor boards don't have a problem, really, with the issue of equipment. Where they wrap themselves in knots is over whether staffing is mandatory for bargaining. And I can tell you there are some general rules around the country. If you look at the country as a whole, I would say that labor boards would hold that police staffing is not mandatory for bargaining. It's a management right to decide how many officers there are, how many officers are assigned to a shift, and the like. Labor boards, though, are of a split mind, typically, where firefighter staffing is concerned. Most labor boards, everyone I know of, for example, has held that firefighter staffing per piece of equipment is mandatory for bargaining. So whether you have three firefighters or four firefighters per rig, that is a negotiable topic. Most labor boards, not all, have held that firefighter staffing per shift or per population is not negotiable. They will say that that gets much more into a core entrepreneurial function of management that is not subject to the bargaining process. So our general rule, law enforcement staffing, not mandatory for bargaining. Firefighter staffing per rig, usually mandatory for bargaining. Firefighter staffing per shift, usually not mandatory for bargaining. And there's a recent decision from Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission that really illustrates this dichotomy. It's a firefighter case. Washington has long ago ruled that police staffing is not mandatory for bargaining. And this is a case that involves the city of Everett, which is a good-sized city, just north of Seattle, and Local 46 of the International Association of Firefighters. For many years, the collective bargaining agreement between the two has contained a minimum staffing requirement. In the 2012-2014 contract, that minimum was 25 firefighters per shift. So the parties get to bargaining. The union proposes increasing minimum shift staffing by a lot, from 25 to 35. The city didn't agree to the proposal, and during bargaining and mediation, notified the union that it viewed shift staffing levels as what's known as a permissive or non-mandatory subject of bargaining. The parties don't reach an agreement on the whole contract. They go to impasse in Washington. That means they head off to interest arbitration. Under the law, though, you can only refer to interest arbitration mandatorily negotiable subjects, wages, hours, and mandatorily negotiable working conditions. The city says, can't take your staffing proposal to interest arbitration because it's not mandatory for bargaining, and that tees the whole issue up for Washington's PERC. And PERC has to decide, is firefighter staffing per shift mandatory for bargaining such that the union can send a dispute to arbitration? And PERC says no. PERC says, look, when we are looking at these issues, we are looking at the specific evidence that is in front of us. We are looking at whether or not, in the context of this case and the facts put on in this case, whether or not shift staffing has an intimate enough relationship to workplace safety that we can say that it is mandatory for bargaining. PERC goes a little bit further and says it could be mandatory for bargaining, not just if the union showed a direct relationship to safety, but also to workload. And PERC says right up front, we know firefighting is a dangerous profession, and many aspects of the job impact safety and health. But whenever you see a labor board or a court saying something really nice about you at the start of the opinion, you better watch as to how the opinion is going to end. And that's what happened with Local 46 in this case. Because in the end, PERC holds that the city had a strong management right in being able to determine shift staffing levels. In the words of PERC, and I'm quoting here, this is consistent with the fact that employers are tasked with determining their mission, setting service levels, and budgeting to provide those services. The union established that firefighters have safety interests related to shift staffing levels. However, the evidence regarding those interests are largely general in nature and do not sufficiently demonstrate a direct relationship between those safety interests and shift staffing levels. Hence, the proposal is not mandatory for bargaining. The union cannot go to binding arbitration on the topic and committed an unfair labor practice when it insisted on submitting the proposal to binding arbitration. Three footnotes, and they're going to be kind of longish footnotes. First footnote, PERC is not saying here that there's a per se rule that all shift staffing is not mandatory for bargaining. Rather, what it is saying is, in this case, the union didn't put on strong enough evidence of a relationship between shift staffing and safety. Could it have done so? I don't know. I've seen it done in other cases. I've seen it done by firefighter associations that have hired expert witnesses who have looked at statistics and done regression analysis and all that sort of stuff and shown an absolute correlation between shift staffing and safety. There's a Pennsylvania case from last month that did precisely that. Footnote one. This doesn't entirely shut the door on whether or not shift staffing is mandatory for bargaining. It simply says that in this case, there wasn't enough evidence of it. Second footnote. PERC is saying that shift staffing here is a permissive subject of bargaining. Permissive subject of bargaining means it's not an illegal subject. An employer can bargain over this, but it doesn't have to under the law. And if a permissive subject of bargaining, in this case, the minimum shift staffing of 25, makes its way into the collective bargaining agreement, it's enforceable for as long as the contract is in effect. It can be enforced. But what happens if you incorporate a permissive subject of bargaining into your contract and the contract expires and you've got a proposal simply to continue that existing language into the next contract? What happens then? And the general rule is, once permissive, always permissive. And if you insist on the continuation of current contract language that is permissive for bargaining, you're committing an unfair labor practice. This is why people who bargain a lot of contracts will tell you, look, you can pursue if you want. You can pursue a permissive subject of bargaining at the negotiations table, but don't pay anything for it. You know, don't swap it for something in the total compensation structure that is valuable to you. This is advice given to both sides. That's going to be footnote 3. Don't do that. Because then, when your contract expires, the other side will look at you and say, hey, it's still permissive. You want to buy it again? So those of us who represent either unions or management give pretty consistent advice to our clients here. Don't be paying anything to include a permissive subject of bargaining in the contract. And the third footnote is, that same advice applies to management. What is there in a contract that is permissive for bargaining, not a mandatory subject to bargaining, that management wants? And the answer is, and again, this is, I have to qualify this constantly by saying in most states, because for all of these propositions about this issue I'm talking about, there's a majority rule and a minority rule. So I'm going to talk about the majority rule. In most states, a management rights clause is not a mandatory subject to bargaining. Why not? Management rights clause is nothing more than a waiver of a union's right to bargain, and waivers themselves are not mandatory for bargaining. And that says, if you're an employer and you really, really want that long-form management rights clause that may extend over 2 single-space pages in your contract, and you've got a union you're dealing with that is well advised on this subject, the union may just cross its arms, figuratively or literally, look at you across the bargaining table and say, you want that management rights clause? What's it worth to you? So this is a rule, footnote 3, about not referring permissive subjects of bargaining to impasse. This is a rule that applies both to management and labor. So at any rate, interesting shift staffing case, firefighter shift staffing case out of Washington. I don't think it really announces any great new legal principles, but these cases are being increasingly litigated right now across the country, so I thought it'd be worth spending a little bit of time on. Next up, I want to talk about the firefighter's rule. And by the way, the question in this case is, should the firefighter's rule be extended to police? So what's the firefighter's rule? This, by the way, is a case out of the Kansas Supreme Court. Firefighter rule is it's a very little-known legal principle, and I find that whenever I talk about it at one of our seminars, it rarely fails to surprise people who are in attendance that this thing exists. Under the firefighter's rule, firefighters, and often, but not always, law enforcement officers, are barred from suing third parties whose negligence has caused them injuries on the job. So Joe Citizen does something incredibly negligent, whatever it might be, driving their car in an incredibly negligent way. Perhaps in their backyard, they dug a 20-foot pit and covered it with newspaper and then spread dust on the top so that nobody knows. You know, whatever it is, a horrible act of negligence. And as a result, when a police officer or a firefighter gets on the scene and they are injured as a result of that negligence, if you're in a state where the firefighter's rule exists, you can't sue the person whose negligence injured you. Where did this rule come from? It actually started about 125 years ago with an Illinois Supreme Court decision, and Illinois, by the way, has partially repealed it, but that hasn't stopped it from spreading around the country, and it spread pretty much uniformly. Until the 1980s. Several state Supreme Courts in the 1980s, including my state of Oregon, rejected the firefighters' rule. A handful of state legislatures actually repealed it. But still today, in the majority of states around the country, the firefighters' rule exists. In almost all of those states, it's a creation of the courts. It is not a statute. It's just simply courts saying we are going to create an exception to any citizen's ability to sue for somebody else's negligence, and the exception is going to apply to firefighters and law enforcement officers who are injured in the course of their jobs. Now, there's a lot of fine points on the firefighters' rule. I'm not going to get into them at all. You know, there's different theoretical bases for it, and sometimes they talk about what's known as implied assumption of risk. Sometimes it's what's known as the status rule, whether you're a licensee or an invitee. I said I wasn't going to talk about this stuff, and at any rate, I'm talking about it. So there's a lot of niceties to it, but just think about it generally as a bar on bringing negligence lawsuits against people who injure you on the job. What's going on in the Kansas case? In Kansas, the Kansas Supreme Court had long ago adopted the firefighters' rule with respect to firefighters. And what it had to do in this case was decide whether the firefighters' rule should either be abandoned or extended to include police officers as well. So, what's going on in this case? It's a Riley County, Kansas police officer named Juan Apodaca. He responds to a single truck accident involving that occurred on a four-lane highway. The young truck driver, and this is a pickup truck, who was drunk, exited the truck. He didn't activate his headlights or his flashers. Apodaca, I'm going to mispronounce his name consistently here, responded code to the accident site, thinking that someone was injured in the accident. And as he approaches the accident site, he sees headlights and flashers off in the distance. And so as he's heading to where the headlights and flashers are, he runs into the drunk driver's truck. Where'd the headlights and flashers come from? It was a bystander's standards vehicle, and it was actually a mile away from where the accident was. Apodaca hit the truck at an incredibly high rate of speed. He was going 104 miles an hour. He and his partner were injured, seriously injured, and they file a negligence lawsuit against the drunk driver. He was a young guy, I think he was 18 years old, and his father, who owned the pickup truck. And their argument is, young guy was negligent by not activating his lights and flashers after the initial accident. And this is the issue that goes up to the Kansas Supreme Court, is whether or not the firefighter's rule should be extended to cover law enforcement officers. And the court starts with its formulation of the reason for the firefighter's rule. And I'm going to run this by you for just a couple of seconds because it's important to understand why this rule even exists. And in Kansas, here's the rationale. Firefighters, say the court, enter on a premises to discharge their duties. They're there not because they owe any sort of private duty to the occupant of the premises, but rather to keep the fire confined and to prevent it from spreading to other structures. It's a public policy of the state of Kansas, and I'm quoting now, that a firefighter cannot recover for injuries caused by the very wrong that initially required his presence in an official capacity. And public policy precludes recovery against an individual whose negligence created a need for the presence of the firefighter at the scene. Now, let's pause there for a moment. You probably can tell I have zero use for the firefighter's rule. Actually, that case in Oregon where the court rejected the firefighter's rule, the Oregon Supreme Court did, that was my case. I feel really passionately about this issue. I think it's stupid. It transfers the risk of negligence from the person who is in fact negligent. It transfers it to the employee who is injured and the governmental employer that has to pay for the workers' compensation coverage for the employee who is injured. In what other context do we transfer the risk of negligence to third parties who aren't negligent? And, you know, I don't understand why firefighters and police officers should be treated differently than any of a host of other people who have an obligation to respond to particular types of scenes. This is a rule that I think maybe there was a rationale for it 125 years ago in Illinois. I don't know. I don't think actually it was a good rule back then. Okay, editorial through. Now back to Kansas. So Kansas has to decide whether this firefighter's rule should be extended to law enforcement officers. And the court says, yeah, it should, a majority of the court. The court says, look, you have to consider that the duties of firefighters overlap or are similar. Here, both police officers and firefighters respond to traffic accidents. The court ends up saying that at the extension of the firefighter rules to firefighters rule to law enforcement officers is consistent with the purposes of the rule, and that a majority of other jurisdictions where the firefighter's rule is still in effect, a majority of them apply it to law enforcement officers, and in fact, that is correct. But where the court's like flat out wrong is, remember when I told you what it announced its basis was? For the firefighters' rule, that firefighters cannot recover for injuries caused by the very wrong that caused them to be present at the scene. Think about Apodaca's case. What was the wrong that caused him to be present at the scene? Well, the wrong was a drunk driver crashed his truck. Is that the negligence that Apodaca was suing for? No. He was suing because the drunk driver didn't activate his lights and his flashers. That's not the reason he was called to the scene. So the court, I think, just is flat out mistaken about, on the facts of this case, why it would ever extend the rule to law enforcement officers. We have Kansas joining the majority of states in this country in applying the firefighter's rule to both law enforcement officers and firefighters. It wasn't an easy decision for the court. There were three very vigorous dissenting opinions from other justices. As one justice put it, I love this sentence, I dissent from the majority's unjustified expansion of the singularly arbitrary, capricious, and constitutionally suspect firefighter's rule. I sure hope that justice spent like an hour constructing that sentence because it's just about perfect. What do you do if the firefighter's rule exists in your state? What do you do if this concerns you? If this concerns you that your firefighters, your police officers, your deputy sheriffs, your troopers can be seriously injured or killed in the line of duty due to somebody's negligence, and you can't make a recovery from the negligent person or their insurance company. How do you handle this? Well, what you do is you do what a bunch of state legislatures have done, or so what police officers and firefighters in these states have done. You go to your legislature and you get them to statutorily repeal the firefighters' rule. It's been done in a lot of places. New York, for example, has largely statutorily repealed the firefighters' rule. It used to be very vigorous there. A bunch of states have done that. That's the solution here. Rather than relying on convincing judges to overturn decades-old precedent, the solution is to go to the legislature and look at them and say, why should we be different? Why should we, public safety employees, why should we, public safety employers, be treated less generously, more harmfully than any other type of employee or employer? That's wrong. And you, if you bring this to a legislature, I predict you're going to get a lot of traction. I want to wrap up by talking about a free speech case. And this case that comes from a pretty high up court, the Third Circuit Federal Court of Appeals. Think New Jersey, Pennsylvania, that area of the country. That's where the Third Circuit is. This is yet another case. It is a progeny of Supreme Court's 2006 decision of Garcetti versus Zabalos. The Garcetti case, without question, is the most impactful constitutional law case in the last several decades that impacts the public safety workplace. What did the Garcetti opinion hold? In it, the Supreme Court changed about 50 years of jurisprudence by holding that if a public employee engages in speech arising out of their job, the speech has no free speech protections. It doesn't matter if it's whistleblowing speech. It really doesn't matter what kind of speech it is. If the speech arises out of your job, it has no free speech protections, and it is constitutionally permissible for the employer to retaliate against you by disciplining you or firing you because of the speech. There have been hundreds of lower court opinions that have followed in the wake of Garcia. Haven't counted them. If I had, I might even be able to tell you it's over 1,000 now. And almost all of them find a wide variety of speech by public employees unprotected under Garcetti. Courts have held, for example, that there's no free speech protection for cooperating with a criminal investigation relating to the job. Why not? Is it part of your job to cooperate with a criminal investigation? Yeah. Therefore, your cooperation is not constitutionally protected, and you can be fired for cooperating with a criminal investigation. There are several cases that say that when you testify truthfully in an internal affairs investigation, no free speech protections under Garcetti. Why not? Is it part of your job to testify truthfully in an internal affairs investigation? Sure. That means you are shorn of free speech protections under Garcetti. Now, there's a lot of employees who are in a union environment who have many other protections against improper discipline for speech. You know, you might be able to file a grievance under a collective bargaining agreement. You might be able to file a civil service appeal or a public safety commission appeal. What Garcetti does is to strip those employees of what often had been their best remedy, which was a civil rights lawsuit under Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act. But for employees in a non-union environment, the First Amendment was all they had in some of these cases. And with Garcetti, they have no remedy whatsoever. So, huge sea change in the law. One federal court of appeals looking on Garcetti from about 3 or 4 years after the fact said that Garcetti caused, a revolution in constitutional law. And I completely agree with that. So, how does Garcetti apply to safety complaints. You have an employee who sees something in the workplace where they think there's an unsafe working environment. They report the unsafe working condition through channels, and they're retaliated against by the employee. Does Garcetti prohibit the employer from that retaliation? Well, this is a case, this Third Circuit case, involving a probationary police officer. So her name is Enid Santiago. Since she's probationary, she's one of these people who doesn't really have any job protections other than the First Amendment in this sort of situation. She's a probationary officer with the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. In 2009, she was assigned to work outside the Lincoln Tunnel, where she was responsible for directing vehicles that were too tall for the tunnel to turn around in a parking lot. Prior to the date in question, she'd been pretty successful on her job. She'd extricated a number of overheight vehicles from the tunnel's entrance, preventing, of course, a huge backup in the tunnel if, in fact, the top of the vehicle scrapes the top of the tunnel. Santiago, when she's working that night, she's on a graveyard shift, responds to an alarm that an overheight truck was headed towards the entrance to the tunnel. She attempted to assist the truck driver, and she runs afoul of somebody who's employed as what's called a bridge agent for the Port Authority. The bridge agent comes and starts to give contrary instructions to the driver. Santiago tells the bridge agent to stop interfering. She then went to stop incoming traffic so the truck could complete the turn. And when she's stopping the traffic, she turns around and she sees the bridge agent directing the driver to get moving and go through the tunnel. And before she could give her instructions to the driver again, the truck hits a parked vehicle. Santiago and the bridge agent then, believe it or not, get into an argument. Santiago calls for backup, and the situation finally calms down. She completes a motor vehicle accident report and another document that is described in the authority, the Port Authority, as a handwritten report. This is a type of filing that officers can use to report anything out of the ordinary. When you're thinking report, think speech, right? A report is nothing more than written speech as far as the First Amendment is concerned. Santiago's handwritten report complains of the bridge agent's interference with what she was trying to do, and she describes the bridge agent's behavior as unacceptable and harmful to the public. Think safety complaint, harmful to the public. Well, an investigation ensues, and the Port Authority decides that Santiago's responsible for the accident. It also decides that she'd been dishonest during the investigation, and she's fired. One day before her probationary period is set to end, she's fired. She brings a free speech lawsuit. She says, I wasn't dishonest, and said that, in fact, the accident wasn't my fault. The court, lower court, assumes that all of that Santiago says is true, assumes that Santiago was not dishonest, and assumes that, in fact, it was the bridge agent who caused the problem. It still dismisses her lawsuit, and the Federal Court of Appeals agrees. Why does it agree? It agrees because of Garcetti. The court says, by the very nature of her position, Garcetti was expected to report public safety problems. It is expected that an officer will report risks to public safety up the chain of command, particularly when the risk is caused by another employee of the government agency. So, in other words, Santiago's job required her to write this report. That means no constitutional protection. That means no problem with the Port Authority firing her in retaliation for completing What we have to assume is a completely truthful memorandum about a legitimate safety problem. That's Garcetti in action. Now, the court stresses one other thing. And the court says, look, under Garcetti, the only type of speech really that has protection is speech as a citizen, speech directed at the public. And the court says that's another reason Santiago Luz is here. She directed her speech, the report, up the chain of command. While the intended audience may not be the singular most dispositive aspect of this case, it is an important one. We think that writing this report was part of Santiago's ordinary job responsibilities, therefore, no constitutional protection. What these Garcetti cases tell you is that if you're a public employee, resort to the First Amendment is going to be a very chancy proposition, and that anybody looking to challenge disciplinary action based upon speech where they think the speech is protected, they're going to have a whole lot better luck than just about any other place than in federal court under the First Amendment. What's really tough is for people like Santiago, assuming again everything she said is true here, what's really tough is for people like her don't have any place other than federal court, because as the Third Circuit said, she doesn't even have a place in that court. Well, that's it for our June 2017 podcast. Before I sign off, I do want to remind you we've got this communications seminar that we're doing in Las Vegas in August 2017. This one's designed for unions, and it's designed specifically to assist unions in how they communicate their message, public safety employees, how they can tell their story best to the public, to their members, through traditional media, through social media, and through being proactive in telling their story. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off. Have a great month, and we'll see you probably right around the 4th of July on our next First Thursday podcast.